Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day with information that helps you learn and improve your American English skills. If you are hearing us on the radio, we urge you to find us on the internet also. That way you can save the program and listen to it again and again. Practice saying the words the way we do. It is a great way to learn English, and it's free. Today, we are going back into the classroom to talk about technology. It is one area where phrasal verbs and new nouns are very common. The VOA Everyday Grammar Team joins us to present a history of phrasal verbs in computing and new nouns that grew from these phrasal verbs. Jill Robbins gets us started.
This is our third episode on phrasal verbs. As you know, a phrasal verb is a phrase with two or more words, a verb and a preposition or adverb or both. Today, we look at very current phrasal verbs, ones used with technology. The digital age has created many new words and phrases in English. The world of technology is fast changing, and it has broken many traditions. It is natural that the language of computers would also change and be informal. Not only is the language of technology full of phrasal verbs, it is also full of new nouns. Many of those nouns grew out of phrasal verbs, as you will learn in this episode.
Let's go back to 1969, when the first verb sent over the internet was a phrasal verb, log in. To log in is to enter a code, key, or password to gain access to the computer's abilities. We have been logging in ever since then. Sometimes we say we have to sign in to a web page. Like now, we started a computer by hooking up wire cables and then powering it up or turning it on. Some computers took a long time to boot up or get ready to run programs. Now, we do not have to wait as long. To install new applications on the computer, users run a setup program. Then we click on the icon or image for a program to run it. After opening a program, you choose commands from a menu. These menus are stored in a pull-down or drop-down bar near the top of the screen. A click of the mouse, the handheld device that guides the cursor around the computer screen, shows more commands on the bar. That bar is often called the navigation bar or nav bar. This leads us to our first noun from a phrasal verb, pull down. When we give instructions to a friend about using a web page, we can say, "Look in the nav bar for the pull down and choose a command." Another verb that describes up and down movement on the screen is scroll up or scroll down. A wheel on the mouse allows you to scroll up or scroll down to read a web page. We can click on an arrow to move to the next screen, too.
Thank you.
Installing upgrades can sometimes damage files, so users should always back up their files. That is, copy files and folders to another location, like an external disk drive. A user who stores many large files will soon run out of room on the computer, so keeping files on an extra hard drive is a good idea. This phrasal verb became a noun too. Experts tell us, put your backups in a safe place. My parents used to print out their emails because they wanted to keep a permanent copy. And here is another new noun, a printout. The phrasal verb printout is a separable phrasal verb, like the ones we talked about in a previous episode. That means you can put a pronoun between the verb and preposition, as in, let me print it out for you. Even when we use passwords, criminals have learned to enter a computer or a network without permission. They are hacking into the network. Hacking can make computer systems go down or stop working. A disaster could happen if the hacker wiped out or erased all the information on a computer system. That is why you back up your system.
Internet advertisements, or ads, pop up on the screen over a web page. This created a new noun from the phrasal verb, pop up. People said they needed a tool to block those annoying ads, so the pop-up blocker was born. This feature is part of the browser software. Speaking of browsers, another phrasal verb that became a noun is plug-in. You know that you can plug a wire into the wall. Now, we add small programs to perform specific tasks in the computer and call them plug-ins. Companies often will ask for your email address. They create a large list of users from their email addresses. When we sign up to use a website, we key in our name and email address. The organization running an online service usually asks us to opt in or choose to receive email messages. Usually, those messages are asking us to buy products. There are so many of these emails now that many people try to filter out all messages from advertisers, otherwise known as spam.
If you think that the internet is full of too many advertisements and your email is nothing but spam, just click on the menu to shut down and turn off your devices for the day. Get off what we called the information superhighway and take a walk outside. Wait, there's one final phrasal verb to describe that. Go offline. For Learning English Everyday Grammar, I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm John Russell.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. A California man who was feeling sick almost died recently from a shocking cause. 26-year-old Luis Ortiz went to a hospital because of a headache and nausea. When doctors examined him, they were shocked to find a tapeworm larva in his brain. The story gets stranger. The larva was still alive. The creature had caused a cyst to form inside his head. The cyst was restricting the flow of liquids to different areas of the brain. The situation was so serious that doctors said they had to perform an emergency operation to remove the larva. The Associated Press reports that a doctor who operated on Ortiz told him he had only 30 minutes to live. The California man told ABC News that when the doctor pulled the worm out of his head, it was still moving. Luis Ortiz was a student at California State University in Sacramento. He began experiencing headaches in late August, he told a local newspaper. But Ortiz said he did not think the headaches were serious. In September, he visited a friend and his parents in another city. That is when the pain got worse. His mother reportedly saw Ortiz throwing up. She took him to a hospital emergency room. Ortiz told ABC News that he was shocked. He said he couldn't believe something like that would happen to him. He said he did not know there was a parasite trying to ruin his life. The doctors saved Ortiz's life, however, the surgery also affected it. According to ABC News, Ortiz had to drop out of school and move back home. It said for now he is not permitted to work or drive a vehicle. Tapeworms and other parasitic worms usually infect a person's intestinal system. In rare cases, they infect the brain. Doctors suspect Ortiz ate something containing the tapeworm. You can get a tapeworm from food that is unclean and contaminated with tapeworm eggs. People can get them from eating infected, undercooked, or uncooked pork. Another type of tapeworm can infect beef. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the U.S. has about 1,000 reported cases of tapeworm each year. The CDC adds that tapeworms are more common in developing countries with poor public health systems. According to CDC officials, signs of infection with a parasitic worm include stomach pain, nausea, loss of appetite, and weight loss. Other signs are a lasting headache and vomiting. The best way to avoid a tapeworm infection is to wash fruits and vegetables. Also, make sure meat is cooked thoroughly. The CDC suggests cooking all meats to an internal temperature of at least 63 degrees Celsius. Separately, the CDC says tapeworms could spread cancer. This comes after studying the case of a Colombian man who died after catching the disease from a tapeworm that had infected him. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. President Abraham Lincoln led the Union of Northern States in 4 years of civil war against the Southern Confederacy. But he did not live to see the end of the war. He did not live to see the nation reunited. He was assassinated in April of 1865. This week in our series, Shep O'Neill and Morris Joyce tell what happened after Lincoln died.
Almost immediately, officials began planning details of the president's funeral. They asked Mrs. Lincoln where she wanted her husband buried. At first, she said Chicago. That was where the Lincolns were going to live after they left the White House. Then she said the Capitol building in Washington. A tomb had been built there for America's first president, George Washington, but it had never been used. Finally, she remembered a country cemetery they had visited. At the time, her husband had said, "When I am gone, lay my remains in some quiet place like this." So Mrs. Lincoln decided that the president's final resting place would be in the quiet, beautiful Oak Ridge Cemetery outside their hometown of Springfield, Illinois.
For several days after Lincoln's assassination, his body lay in the East Room of the White House. The room was open to the public all day. Next, the body was taken to the Capitol building. Again, the public could come to say goodbye. Then the body was put on a special train for the trip back to Illinois. 4 years earlier, President-elect Lincoln had traveled by train from Illinois to Washington. He stopped to make speeches in cities along the way. Now, on this sad return trip, the train stopped at those same cities: Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, Cleveland, Indianapolis, Chicago.
In every town, people lined the railroad. They stood silently with tears in their eyes as the train moved slowly past. Farmers working in the fields saw the train and dropped to their knees in prayer. For the wise man who had led the Union through 4 years of bloody civil war, Father Abraham, was dead. Churches throughout the country held memorial services. Ministers told their people that God had taken Lincoln because the president had completed the job God had given him. He had brought peace to the Union and freedom to all men.
The final service was at the cemetery outside Springfield. It ended with the words from Lincoln's second inaugural speech: "With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in. Let us heal the nation's wounds. Let us do all possible to get and keep a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations."
While the nation mourned Lincoln's death, federal officials investigated his assassination. The man who had shot Lincoln in Ford's Theater was an actor, John Wilkes Booth. He had fled the theater after the murder. The government offered a reward of $100,000 to anyone who captured Booth and his helpers. The investigation produced the names of several people who were friends of Booth. One was John Surratt. Like Booth, he supported the Southern Confederacy during the Civil War. Another was David Harold, a young man who worked in a store in Washington. Others were George Atzerodt, Louis Payne, Sam Arnold, and Michael O'Loughlin. Most of these men had stayed at a house owned by John Surratt's mother, Mary.
One by one, in the days following Lincoln's death, these people were arrested. Anyone else who might have had a part in the plot was seized. Soon, Hundreds of suspects were being held in jails in and around Washington. At the end of a week, only two of the plotters were still free, David Herold and John Wilkes Booth. Booth broke his leg when he jumped from the presidential box to the stage at Ford's Theater. A few hours later, he and Herold stopped at the home of a Dr. Samuel Mudd. They reportedly gave the doctor false names. They asked him to fix Booth's broken leg. Dr. Mudd agreed, and he let the two men sleep at his home. Federal troops chasing the assassins arrested the doctor. They accused him of being part of the plot.
John Wilkes Booth and David Herold ran and hid for 6 days. They crossed the Potomac River from Maryland into Virginia. Finally, 12 days after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, soldiers found the two men. They were hiding in a tobacco barn near the town of Port Royal. Herold agreed to surrender. He came out of the barn with his hands in the air. He shouted again and again that he was innocent. Booth refused to come out. The soldiers set fire to the barn.
The fire forced Booth to move close to the door. The soldiers could see him now. He was aiming a gun at them. The soldiers had been ordered to capture Booth alive, but one of them raised his gun and shot Booth in the neck. The actor fell. Some of the soldiers ran to the burning barn and pulled him out. They carried him to a nearby house. He died 2 hours later.
John Wilkes Booth carried a notebook. He wrote in it every day. On the day Lincoln was killed, he wrote, "For 6 months we had worked to kidnap Lincoln, but with the Confederacy being almost lost, something decisive and great must be done. I struck boldly." Booth described how and why he had shot the president. "Our country," Booth wrote, "owed all her troubles to him, and God simply made me the instrument of his punishment." Booth's body was returned to Washington. Men who knew him confirmed that it was the body of John Wilkes Booth. The body was buried under the stone floor of the Washington prison. A few years later, his family received permission to move the body to a cemetery in the city of Baltimore.
Evidence showed that only a few people were actually involved in the plot against the president. Most had agreed to work with Booth because they believed he planned to kidnap Lincoln, not kill him. Of the hundreds of persons arrested, only 8 were brought to trial. The Secretary of War decided that they would be tried by a military court. He argued that Lincoln had been commander-in-chief of all military forces and had been murdered during wartime.
The trial began almost 2 months after the assassination. The prisoners seemed in poor condition. All wore heavy chains on their arms and legs, and the men had been forced to wear thick cloths over their heads. Officials said the cloths were necessary to prevent them from talking to each other. The Secretary of War announced that the prisoners could not meet privately with their defense lawyers. They could meet only in the courtroom. Guards could hear everything they said. One of the defense lawyers recognized that the job was hopeless. He said the trial was a contest between the defense lawyers and the whole United States. There was no question, he said, what the military court's decision would be.
The government tried to prove that Lincoln's assassination was a Confederate plot. Witnesses told how Confederate supporters reportedly planned to cause trouble in the North. But none could prove that Confederate President Jefferson Davis, or any other Southern leader, played a part in Booth's plot to kill Lincoln. 400 witnesses appeared. Many of the important ones had been arrested as suspects. They agreed to give evidence if the government dropped the charges against them. For 6 weeks, the court heard evidence against the 8 prisoners. The prisoners themselves could say nothing. They could only listen.
In late June 1865, the trial of Abraham Lincoln's assassins ended. The military officers serving as judges met secretly for 2 days. Then they announced their decision. All 8 prisoners were found guilty. One received a prison sentence of 6 years. 3 were sentenced to life in prison. 4 were sentenced to die. Defense lawyers appealed for mercy. The appeal was rejected. On July 7th, David Herold, Louis Payne, George Atzerodt, and Mary Surratt were hanged for the murder of Abraham Lincoln.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Shep O'Neill and Morris Joyce. You can find transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.